From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition.
Another suspected Boko Haram attack kills scores in northeast Nigeria. Liberia said to be gaining upper hand against Ebola. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The militant Islamist group Boko Haram is believed to have struck again in Nigeria's northeast, this time killing scores Monday in the town of Damasak in Borno State near Niger. Witnesses are quoted as saying the gunmen arrived on motorcycles and in pickup trucks armed with weapons, petrol bombs, and other explosives. A U.S. general in Liberia helping in the fight against Ebola Monday reported a dramatic improvement in the situation and confirmed the cancellation of two planned treatment centers. Brigadier General Frank Tate said new daily cases have fallen to around 20 from close to 80 when U.S. military operations began in Liberia in September. Meanwhile, a Dutch naval vessel docked in Monrovia Monday carrying supplies and other aid. The vessel has already visited the other hard-hit countries of Sierra Leone and Guinea. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was on hand, lauding the international support for her country's fight against Ebola.
We know what they've done. This is just a bilateral support, but we also know that all of the members of the European Union have also played our game, and they have supported us in one way or the other for us to have the progress that we have.
She also urged her countrymen to redouble efforts to reach the government's goal of zero new Ebola cases by Christmas Day, December 25. Mali Monday said another person tested positive for the deadly virus, bringing the total number of cases there to 8. The UN Ebola Emergency Response Mission says it will not fully meet its December 1st target for containing the virus because of escalating numbers in Sierra Leone. This is VOA News. The battle for a runoff presidential election in Tunisia kicked off Monday. Veteran anti-Islamist politician Bazi Kaid El Sebsi, whose party placed first in a parliamentary election last month, looked to fall short of the 50% threshold required to win Sunday's ballot outright. He's expected to face off against incumbent Mansif Marzouki, a secular politician who's made common cause with Islamists against what he calls an attempt at a comeback by former loyalists of the autocratic government of Zain el-Abidine Ben Ali, which was overthrown in 2011. The runoff is scheduled for the end of December. In Libya, an unidentified aircraft attacked Tripoli's only operating airport at Mitiga Monday, held by an anti-government Islamist militia coalition. Libyan carriers moved flights to Mitiga after Tripoli's main international airport was damaged by fierce fighting in July. Meanwhile, the country's rival government in Tripoli warned Monday that dialogue might be unsuccessful with the other rival government if led by the United Nations. The Tripoli-based foreign minister, Mohamed Gariani, expressed doubt such a dialogue would work given what he calls the UN's lack of respect for the law or the justice system in Libya. In September, UN Special Envoy Bernardino Leon initiated a dialogue between the North African country's rival governments, one in Tripoli, the other in the internationally recognized one, based in the east, led by Prime Minister Abdallah El Thani. International efforts to mediate between the factions have so far failed to broker a ceasefire. Floods triggered by heavy rains have killed at least 32 people in southern Morocco, where hundreds have been evacuated and roads and buildings swept away. This unidentified Moroccan says while the rains are welcome after months of dry weather, there has been a lot of damage. King Mohammed has ordered authorities to take all necessary emergency measures to help support flood victims. Hundreds perished in flash flooding in Morocco back in 1995. The French press agency reports some 100 people were killed last week in the eastern part of Democratic Republic of Congo, blamed on Ugandan rebels. The killings are said to have occurred Thursday near Beni in North Kivu province, where mainly Muslim Ugandan rebels have been blamed for killing hundreds in machete attacks since October. The UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office says tens of thousands have been displaced in the last few weeks. Burkina Faso's new prime minister, Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida, promised Monday to carry out reforms, including tackling corruption. Zida also holds the defense portfolio, is part of an interim government established following the ouster of longtime President Blaise Compaoré last month. 26 ministers, including four members of the military, were named last Sunday following days of negotiations. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some civil society groups say they have concerns about Burkina Faso's new Minister of Culture.
We cannot understand why somebody like him can be appointed as a minister in this cabinet. Therefore, he has to be removed.
Isaka Traore is a member of Burkina Faso civil society in charge of communication and information. South Sudan and Egypt signed new bilateral agreements. Ghana has a funding program to help the extremely poor, and Mali takes steps to prevent the spread of Ebola.
At the border, Malian health workers now check everyone who comes in. They say their orders are to turn back anyone with a medical condition.
That's VOA correspondent Anne Locke in Bamako. Police used breathalyzers to curb traffic carnage on Kenya Road. And a grand jury in the U.S. state of Missouri has decided not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager. Those stories plus Mark Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A grand jury in the Midwestern U.S. state of Missouri has decided not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager during a street confrontation almost 4 months ago. The panel has been considering charges against Darren Wilson, the suburban St. Louis officer who fatally shot Michael Brown on August 9th. Here is St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough with the announcement.
Beginning August 20th and continuing until today, the grand jury worked tirelessly to examine and re-examine all of the testimony of the witnesses and all of the physical evidence. The duty of the grand jury is to separate fact from fiction. After a full and impartial and critical examination of all the evidence in the law and decide if that evidence supported the filing of any criminal charges against Darren Wilson, they accepted and completed this monumental responsibility in a conscientious and expeditious manner. It is important to note here and say again that they are the only people who have heard and examined every witness and every piece of evidence. They discussed and debated the evidence among themselves before arriving at their collective decision. After their exhaustive review of the evidence, the grand jury deliberated over 2 days, making their final decision. They determined that no probable cause exists to file any charge against Officer Wilson and returned a no true bill on each of the 5 indictments. The physical and scientific evidence examined by the grand jury, combined with the witness statements supported and substantiated by that physical evidence, tells the accurate and tragic story of what happened.
In a statement from the White House, President Barack Obama called on Americans to accept the grand jury's decision. He acknowledged some deeply disappointed, even angry at the ruling, but called on all protesters to refrain from violence.
First and foremost, we are a nation built on the rule of law. And so we need to accept that this decision was the grand jury's to make. There are Americans who agree with it, and there are Americans who are deeply disappointed, even angry. It's an understandable reaction. But I join Michael's parents in asking anyone who protests this decision to do so peacefully. Let me repeat Michael's father's words. Hurting others or destroying property is not the answer. No matter what the grand jury decides, I do not want my son's death to be in vain. I want it to lead to incredible change, positive change, change that makes the St. Louis region better for everyone. Now, Michael Brown's parents have lost more than anyone. We should be honoring their wishes. I also appeal to the law enforcement officials in Ferguson and the region to show care and restraint in managing peaceful protests that may occur.
That's U.S. President Barack Obama speaking Monday night from the White House. A member of Burkina Faso's civil society says some people are unhappy with the appointment of Adama Sanyon as Minister of Culture and Tourism, and they would like for his name to be withdrawn from the list of the country's new 26-member cabinet. Isaka Traore, in charge of civil society communication information, says Mr. Sanyon, as prosecutor in the case of the murder of journalist Norbert Zongo in 1998, very little to bring about justice. Zongo had investigated the murder of the driver of Francois Campari. The former president's brother. Traore hopes Prime Minister Lieutenant Colonel Isaac Zida and interim President Michel Kafando will listen to the voices of the Burkinabe people because the government, he said, in which they currently serve came about as a result of the sweat and blood of their people.
There was no criteria for us as a civil society organization or any quota. So it was up to the Prime Minister to appoint if he wants to appoint in his cabinet. Nevertheless, we expect that some people with integrity who have the sense of public management should be appointed. And so far, there is only one case, as I said, who people are not happy and people still really disappointed. And this is the case of Mr. Adama Sagno, who was a prosecutor. He handled a very sensitive case in following the assassination of the journalist, the investigative journalist Mr. Norbert Zongo in 1998. And they never gave justice to Norbert Zongo and his family. And that they didn't found anyone who was responsible for this killing. And so this person cannot be appointed in this cabinet because this cabinet is the result of an uprising of the people of Burkina Faso, grassroots people, some were wounded and killed in the hospital. And to appoint someone like Mr. Adama Sagno is an insult for us as a society organization. Today, there was a demonstration in front of the ministry, and people are asking Mr. Prime Minister Zida to remove Mr. Adama Sagno from his position.
The former prosecutor, you say he prosecuted in the case of the journalist who was murdered. Did the civil society don't want him in this particular government, as you said?
The civil society organization, we don't want him in this cabinet, and the people, the grassroots people, don't want him in the cabinet. That's why they went to this ministry and demonstrated this morning. Because this man who was appointed as the Minister of Culture yesterday evening was not able to bring justice, was not able to bring the victim of this killing. We cannot understand why somebody like him can be appointed as a ministry in this cabinet. Therefore, he has to be removed.
Do you think Mr. Kafando is going to listen to the protesters?
Well, I think if they want peace to remain and stability to remain in this country, they have to listen to the people because they were not elected. If Mr. Kafando and Mr. Zida are where they are today, it's because of the people who went on the street. They have to listen to the people.
Isaka Traore is a member of Burkina Faso's civil society in charge of communication and information. He was speaking with me from the capital, Ouagadougou. Senegal and Nigeria were able to stop small Ebola outbreaks by closely monitoring those who had contact with a sick person and quickly isolating anyone with symptoms. Mali is scrambling to do the same now, almost a month after a 70-year-old Guinean imam sought treatment at a clinic in Bamako. Five people have already died. Viewers and Look reports from Mali on what the country is doing to shut down the chain of transmission.
Every day, twice a day, teams are checking just over 300 people around Bamako. All of these contacts are linked to the Ghanaian imam, who died of Ebola at a private clinic October 27th, 2 days after he had arrived for treatment. Monitors have caught just one case so far, a female relative of a nurse who died after treating the imam. The nurse had the most contacts, 98. BOA accompanied monitors to the house. At least 40 family members line up in the courtyard to have their temperatures taken. Two boys, the self-appointed soap police, man a hand-washing station at the door. The head of the household scolds one boy who takes too long to get up when his name is called. The monitors ask about symptoms. The first half of one monitor's spreadsheet is column after column of tiny handwritten zeros. No symptoms. Not all of the contacts are as cooperative as this family. A few do go missing. Monitors think one man went to his village, but phone networks are bad. You haven't been able to reach him, Dr. Ramada Sako asked the team at a meeting later. Didn't we tell him not to travel? Dr. Sako is coordinating Ebola monitoring efforts. The teams are learning on the job. If they don't come to us, we go to them, she tells the team. If we can't figure out his village, we can see if there's a health post there and get him that way. Because this is a critical period, she says. We don't want him to develop symptoms there. Mali is playing catch-up. The circle of contacts widened rapidly in the 2 weeks that went by before health authorities here found out about the imam. The clinic had not tested him. The World Health Organization in Guinea figured it out while investigating other cases in the imam's family. Dr. Ibrahima Sose Fall of the WHO in Mali got the news. By then, at least three people in Mali were already sick. It's a cautionary tale for other countries in the region. Dr. Fall says this never should have happened in a private or a public clinic. Everyone knows the situation in Guinea. Had we known sooner, he says, we could have prevented a certain number of contacts. It was late. Mali is investigating the clinic and how the sick imam got past border police in Koromale. The town straddles the border. The imam was from the Ghanaian side. He was buried there after he died in Bamako. At the border, Malian health workers now check everyone who comes in. Health workers write down names, phone numbers, destinations. They say their orders are to turn back anyone with a medical condition. But an infected person may not show symptoms at the border. Ebola has a 21-day incubation period. The whole country has to be vigilant. And look, VOA News, Koromale, Mali.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 25th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. A social cash transfer program in Ghana under which funds and health insurance premiums are provided by government to extremely poor families now covers more than 77,000 households throughout the country. Joanna Mante tells us more about the program from Accra.
The program, known as Livelihood Empowerment Against Poverty, has been going on for 6 years now. Its broad objective is to lessen the impact of poverty on society's most vulnerable people. Beneficiaries, including orphans, people with severe disabilities, and the aged, are given bi-monthly cash support ranging from $15 to $30 per family. The program is administered by the Department of Social Welfare and Ministry of Gender, Children and Social Protection. Mauto Ablo is a director at the ministry. He says an impact assessment indicates that funds given out generate multiplier effects in local communities that results in a twofold increase in the amount of money flowing in the economy.
Some are investing it, and some also, you know, they buy goods and services from the community. So it creates opportunity for those who are selling also to bring in more, you know, goods and services to provide to the community. And by so doing, the money is affecting even those who are non-beneficiaries.
Participants are allowed to enlist on condition that they immunize and send their children to school. Ablo says that initiative is improving on the education status of children from poor families. But there are challenges. The program is supported by government and donor partners such as UNICEF and aid agency Department for International Development. There have been instances when budgetary constraints have created funding difficulties for Ghana's government and delayed financial support to beneficiaries.
That belongs to history. We used to have this problem in the past, but for almost 1.5 years now, we have been very, very regular in the disbursement of the grant.
However, cash transfer for the months of September and October were made in November this year. Other limitations include the need for capacity building for staff at the district level, where most of the funds are disbursed. Some caregivers also create difficulties by collecting and keeping monies meant for upkeep of their older relatives. Ablo explains.
Initially, some people thought it's just a handout, so we need to do a lot of sensitization for people to understand, sharing the results of the impact assessment to indicate that indeed cash transfers can contribute to social and economic development.
Minister of Gender, Children and Social Protection, Nana Oyelita, says there are plans to scale up the program to cover 150,000 households by 2015. Some five beneficiaries at Jamestown in Accra told this reporter they would like to see an upgrade in their health insurance status to cover a wider treatment option. Joanna Manti for VOA News, Accra.
South Sudan officials have been given details of numerous bilateral agreements reached between South Sudan President Salva Kiir and his Egyptian counterpart Abdel Fattah el-Sisi following their recent meeting in Cairo. The agreements, signed on Saturday, will yield numerous development projects for South Sudan worth $26 million. Philipton Aliu reports for VOA from Juba.
Awana Riag, the minister in President Kiir's office, briefed reporters in Juba yesterday about the details of President Kiir's trip to Cairo last week. Riag says the nine ministers, and several businessmen who accompanied President Kiir met with the Egyptian counterparts and agree on many projects.
These included the areas of water and electricity, education, youth and sports, petroleum, and many other things, including the health. So it was a very successful visit, and both countries are looking to close their ties together to benefit from the expertise of one another and also the resources that are in our country.
Diak says Egyptian President El-Sisi held a one-to-one meeting with President Kiir to discuss issues of mutual interest to both countries. South Sudan and Egypt are members of the Nile Basin Initiative, or NBI, which brings together nations connected by the Nile River. Egypt is a loggerhead with Ethiopia over the construction of multi-million dollar Ethiopian dams that Egypt says will dramatically reduce the volume of the Nile River. Minister Yak says Ethiopian new dams on the Nile and their impact on Egypt, South Sudan, and other countries in the NBI were discussed by the two leaders.
The issues to do with the Nile water, where we need to clear the River Nile so that more water could go, because these are all things that were embodied in the visit, and we are looking forward to see them progressing.
Diak says clearing the Nile, which involves removing sand and cutting papyrus, will also allow river transportation between Sudan, South Sudan, and Egypt to resume. He says transporting goods by water will be much cheaper than transporting them by air, which is how companies in Cairo and Juba normally do business. Both countries also agreed to collaborate on 10 water projects worth $23 million, which are slated to start next month. Some analysts believe the cooperative agreement between Juba and Cairo is an attempt to dissuade the world's newest nation from constructing hydroelectric dams on the Nile. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
Kenya rolls claim more than 3,000 fatalities each year. In a bid to reduce drunk driving-related accidents, breathalyzers have been deployed throughout the country. A special task force has been charged with ensuring that the rolls are kept free from those who violate the law. And authorities say it seems to be paying off. Lenny Ruvaga has more from Nairobi.
It is 10 p.m. along one of Kenya's busiest highways, Jogoo Road in Nairobi. Police have set up a roadblock to conduct random checks for intoxicated drivers. Breathalyzers, which measure blood alcohol content from air expelled from a person's mouth, were first introduced in Kenya 3 years ago to curb a steep increase in drunken driving accidents and deaths. A breathalyzer kit costs approximately $2,000. And the National Transport and Safety Authority has deployed 12 kits throughout the country. The NTSA works in tandem with the Kenyan police, so police cannot solicit bribes from drivers caught intoxicated. Cosmas Ngesu from the NTSA says this approach helps with enforcement of drunk driving laws.
What we have also done is we have partnered with the Kenya Anti-Corruption Commission. We also monitor this operation, send their people. So we are taking initiative for corruption. Yes.
Since January alone, more than 3,000 people have died on Kenyan roads, with 80% of those deaths attributed to drunken driving. Ngesu says those figures represent a drop from just a few years ago, and he says the public is getting the intended message from the police breathalyzer checks.
We used to record a high level of crashes, particularly over the weekend and months, caused by people driving from pubs drunk. But since we started, the statistics have gone down. Additionally, we have created awareness. Now many people choose to take taxis home after drinking instead of drinking and driving. So the awareness is created.
And this is why George Karau looks forward to the weekend, when he can catch up with friends over drinks after a long week and not worry about driving home. He is a client of Smart Fellas, a cab company which caters to clients who are over the legal alcohol limit. Within an hour's notice, they will meet you at the bar or restaurant and drive you home in your own car for an affordable membership fee of $20 to $50 per year. Karau says he signed up as soon as he heard of the service.
Road conduct has been the main concern for everyone. And so when you have a service like this, you have the option of still having a good time and getting home in one piece.
The taxi fees are cheaper than getting caught on the road intoxicated and having to go to court. Those found guilty of drunk driving face fines of up to $1,000 and 2 years in jail. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mongo Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African sports news, we begin with football. The Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA has declined the Royal Morocco Football Federation's invitation to the opening match at the FIFA Club World Cup in the Moroccan capital Rabat next month, COSAFA disclosed in Johannesburg, South Africa on Monday. COSAFA brings together the national football associations of Angola, Botswana, Comoro Islands, Lesotho, Madagascar, Malawi, Mauritius, Mozambique, and Namibia, Seychelles, South Africa, Swaziland, Zambia and Zimbabwe. COSAFA's action could mark the start of an African backlash against Morocco for withdrawing from hosting the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations scheduled to kick off on the 17th of January, claiming it is to prevent the spread of the Ebola disease to Morocco. The Moroccans are keen to stage the FIFA Club World Cup next month. Apart from Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan and Algeria's newly crowned Orange Africa Champions League title holders Intensitive, the other five teams in the contest come from outside Africa. Yet 13 of the 16 teams set to play in the Nations Cup hail from sub-Saharan Africa. COSAFA pledged its full support to the Global Watch campaign, whose clarion call is no to racism and discrimination in sports. In cycling, 20-year-old Valin Ndayisenga won the Tour of Rwanda in the Rwanda capital Kigali over the weekend. He's the first Rwandese cyclist to win the Tour of Rwanda since the inception of the annual week-long cycling contest in 2009. Rwanda's Jean Bosco Nsengimana was second ahead of Eritrean Aaron Debretsion. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian former champions Wuda Ayeleu and Asmerao Bekele were crowned women's and men's winners at the Great Ethiopian Run, Africa's biggest 10-kilometer road race in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa on Sunday. Ayeleu covered the distance in 34 minutes and 4 seconds to win her third title, having prevailed in 2008 and 2009. Bekele clocked 30 minutes and 12 seconds to claim the men's crown. He also won the event in 2010. Finally, World Championship 5,000-meter silver medalist Mercy Cherono and Doris Chengeiwo clinched a Kenyan 1-2 triumph in the women's race at the IAAF cross-country permit meet in Soria, Spain on Sunday. Uganda's Timothy Toroitich prevailed in the men's race. Eritrean Tekle Mariam Mehdim was runner-up ahead of Kenyan Emmanuel Bett. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A grand jury in the Midwestern U.S. state of Missouri has decided not to indict a white police officer who shot and killed an unarmed black teenager during a street confrontation almost 4 months ago. St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough announced late Monday that the grand jury found no probable cause to file charges against Darren Wilson. He was the Ferguson City police officer who fatally shot Michael Brown on August 9. In a statement from the White House, President Barack Obama called on Americans to accept the grand jury's decision. That's it for this Tuesday, November 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Strarek, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very, very good Tuesday.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz. 19.2-meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.